Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Disruptors, an IFT podcast that brings you the latest insights and perspectives from some of the brightest minds in the science of food. Each episode, our guests discuss the ever-changing intersection of entrepreneurship, innovation, and science, and their role in advancing our global food system. This week, we're partnering with IFT's Muscle Foods division to explore the development of new technologies and the challenges associated with developing food products with these technologies. We'll discuss examples from the past, including bioengineering technology, and a present example, cellular agriculture, and the ability to produce foods from cell cultures. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden, and today I'm joined by Kelly Kleinsmith and Lauren Sammel, members of the Muscle Foods Division leadership team. The division focuses on research and advancements of the utilization of muscle foods from farm to fork, and while doing so, furthering the professional development of its academic and industry members. Thanks for joining you two.
Hi, thanks for having us.
I'd also like to welcome our guest, Dr. Larissa Rudenko, visiting scholar at the Program on Emerging Technologies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Hi, Larissa.
Hi, thank you very much for the invitation.
Thanks for being here. So let's just dive right in. Larissa, you must have a great passion for food technology, given your excitement about the topic. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and any sort of current areas of interest or focus for you?
Sure. Actually, my underlying passion has always been for emerging biotechnologies, and food just happens to be one of them. But I've been working in the food arena on and off for my entire career. My doctoral degree is in molecular biology. I'm a board certified toxicologist. I've worked in the consultancy field. I've worked for venture capital. I spent 15 years at FDA developing a science-based program for regulating products relevant to animals. And now I finished that off with a sabbatical at MIT, and I'm currently following up in another position at MIT right now where I'm looking at governance of emerging biotechnologies as opposed to strictly their regulation.
So I think your history with the FDA is really interesting, because I can imagine there's some significant regulations or even different obstacles for new technologies when it comes to regulations and food. So I was wondering if you could discuss pathways for the safety assessment of products that include new technologies, and maybe even provide perspective in terms of whether it's an FDA or USDA regulated product.
Okay, well, I'm really going to concentrate on FDA because that's the area in which I've worked, although we have worked very closely with our friends and colleagues at our sister agencies at USDA. I think the first thing to remember is that all food must be safe. The second thing to remember is in the United States, we regulate products and not the processes by which they're made, although the processes by which they're made contribute or can contribute to their safety or concerns about their safety. So, for example, in the genetically engineered plant world, there are voluntary consultations that occur between producers of foods from genetically engineered plants and the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at FDA. Now, I know people like to talk about GMOs, and GMO has become a word that gets tossed around a lot. But at FDA, we don't really use the phrase GMO. It's a colloquialism that has no regulatory meaning at all. At the FDA, we consider molecular processes to be bioengineering or genetic engineering. And in general, you don't eat an entire organism. So you don't eat a GMO unless you're eating, for example, yogurt and swallowing a live bacterium that happens to be genetically engineered. And I'm not aware of any genetically engineered bacteria being used in yogurt. I'm just using that as an example for when one might eat an organism. Instead, we eat food from genetically engineered sources, whether those sources are plants or animals. So you're the Muscle Foods division. You're probably most interested in food from animals. And at the FDA, we have regulated food from genetically engineered animals, interestingly, under the new animal drug provisions of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And that does not mean that the genetically engineered animal is a drug. It means that the genetically engineered animal contains an article that it is intended to alter the structure or function of the body of the animal, which is one of the definitions of a drug. And it is an animal drug. And it is a new animal drug because it is something that has not been approved. So in the case of a traditionally genetically engineered animal, like the AquaAdvantage salmon, for example, the inserted piece of DNA is the article that is regulated under the new animal drug provisions of the Act. The fish is not a drug. There's a guidance that's out now for which we are in draft form, on which the agency has received comment and is awaiting, I think we're all awaiting the agency's decision on how the agency is going to be treating animals that have been genetically altered by genome editing. And I think the thing that's important about genome editing is that there are three things that can happen when you use genome editing like CRISPR. You can make a small change of a nucleotide. You can introduce a gene from anywhere else into a specific site, or you can delete regions of the DNA of the genome that range from a couple of nucleotides to thousands of nucleotides. And so the agency was asking for data and information that the public could provide to help the agency determine what the risks might be and if all of the animals developed using genome engineering needed to be regulated to the same level. I do not know when they are going to issue a decision or what that decision will be because I'm no longer at the agency.
Larissa, you had mentioned that product is regulated and not the process. That can be hard to grasp. Do you think it's well understood by the general public that it's the product and not the process?
I think that's a really great point. I think the general public, of course, doesn't really understand very much about the fine points of U.S. regulatory authorities or anybody else's regulatory authorities, and seem to be most attracted to the technologies because they are kind of interesting, fun to some people and scary to other people. So no, I don't think the public really understands that products are being regulated until and unless there's actually an agency decision coming out, such as an approval. And then they understand that there is an approval for a particular animal that has a particular trait. But sometimes that particular approval is tainted by people's concerns about the technology itself, or is applauded for the technology itself. So regulators often find themselves in a very tough spot. You know, the rule of thumb is if you feel like you're being equally beaten up by both sides, on either side, that you are in about the right spot. So industry thinks often that there's too much regulation. A lot of consumer and citizen groups think there's insufficient regulation, and there we are.
So it really seems like there's quite a few different pathways that a company could take with these new technologies to kind of get them to market, depending on which agencies they needed to navigate or which sort of groups they might need to consult with. Is that a correct characterization?
I would say that it's not that there are many. It depends on what the product is and its intended use. And I think, again, for the muscle division, we're talking about probably terrestrial and aquatic organisms whose flesh is consumed as food. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they would either come to FDA if they had been genetically engineered. Fish in general are often regulated by FDA, except for catfish, which go to USDA. And then, of course, slaughter is something that is regulated by USDA entirely, except when FDA needs to inform USDA about withdrawal periods and times for drugs that may have been administered to those animals.
Interesting. And really, you've worked with a number of products that include new technologies over your career. So I'm curious if you could expand on sort of a pathway for a product that has successfully navigated the regulatory and consumer acceptance in order to come to market.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I think most of the products, I've worked a lot on developing policies and then trying to implement those policies. Very, very early on in my career, I helped work on the Flavor Saver tomato from Calgene in the plant world. Mm-hmm. And then I worked on a number of microorganisms for various food companies that were using them either as clarifying agents or anti-browning agents, or they had some intended use either as food additives or were subject to GRAS notification. So those are pretty much success stories because they did not, there's a pathway that's well established and you had to demonstrate safety according to guidelines that are pretty well laid out by the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition that ask for the, you have to demonstrate that the strain is not toxic. You have to characterize the construct that's going into the microorganism strain. You have to show that there's nothing toxic about the organism or the construct. And then you have to talk about what the uses are going to be, the estimated maximum usage of those products. And then based on toxicology studies, some of which are standard and some of which are specific to the particular product that's being considered, develop a safe level of exposure. And I think it's important to remember that a GRAS notification doesn't mean this is generally recognized as safe for any use. It means generally recognized as safe for a particular intended use and recognized by a group of scientific experts who have the qualifications to make those decisions. It's not just asking your grandmother in your sewing circle if they think it's safe.
I always ask my sewing circle if it's generally.
Hi, Larissa. I have a question. This is Kelly. I'm just curious, just back to the genetic engineering, plant versus animal. Now that we have this draft guidance out there, is there any parallels that we can see between genetically engineered plants is in comparison to what the draft is out there for what we're looking at in terms of any type of genetic modification for animals?
Okay, so again, I'm sorry to be a stickler about this. The agencies do not use the term genetic modification because it is the agency's opinion that we have been modifying the sources of food ever since selective breeding began. So that's the beginning of agriculture. We specifically look at foods that have come from genetically engineered or bioengineered sources. So there's an existing guidance out for genetically engineered animals. And those are animals that have what I like to call biotech version one, which is you take a specific gene at a and put it into a construct that you're pretty sure that's going to express, and you introduce it into an animal, usually via somatic cell nuclear transfer or microinjection, and the location of that insertion is fairly random, and then a fair amount of work needs to be done to demonstrate that that insertion, you can tell where that insertion is, how many copies there are, that it's durable, it doesn't move, it's stable in terms of its location and expression. The guidance that's out and we're waiting for finalization on has to do with genome editing, which generally uses either TALENs or zinc finger nucleases or CRISPR so that the insertion is not at random. The insertion is at a particular site. But regardless, if those animals that have undergone this kind of changes are going to be considered by the agency, they would be considered, again, under the new animal drug provisions of the Act, which means that you have to demonstrate that the change that you've made is safe to the animal, that if the animal is intended for food, that it's safe to consume, and that if the agency is making an approval, that's called a major agency action, then you trigger the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, and you have to do an environmental assessment. So in terms of the safety studies, basically you need to look at the product, what the product of that particular insertion is going to be, whether or not that product is likely to be toxic. The questions about what kinds of studies you need to do really have to be worked out on a case-by-case basis, because as you know, feeding whole food to animals for 90 days or a year at exaggerated levels so perturbs the physiology of the animal that we don't do feeding studies for whole foods. We do feeding studies for molecules or mixtures that you can exaggerate the dose on and actually do toxicological studies for. So I don't know if that helps you, but we also looked at the safety to the animal, which means is the animal essentially a normal animal? What the comparator of choice is very important. You want something that's age appropriate and breed appropriate. So you don't really want to be comparing an Angus cow to a water buffalo, for example. You want to make sure that you're comparing Angus to Angus or Holstein to Holstein. And of the same age group. And we generally look at things like how well the animal puts on weight, how well it thrives. Are there any concerns about its blood work? Running essentially the same kind of work that a vet would run on an animal to see if it was healthy, and its morphology and physiognomy. And then, of course, there's the FSIS ante and postmortem inspection service that goes on.
Wow, thank you, Larissa. That was extraordinarily helpful for understanding the assessment. I had another question in there. I wanted to flip back to the Flavor Saver, which seems to have gone through the regulatory process well, and yet I don't believe that product was on the market for a long period of time. And it seems like it was a great technology with a lot of benefits. Are you able to talk to what happened through the entire life cycle of the product that it didn't stay on market for very long?
Well, there are things I can't talk about because I was involved in it. But I think one of the questions that was there were some economic decisions that were made. For example, the Calgene company was bought out by a larger company. And I think the gene may not have gone into a strain or breed of tomato that was particularly attractive to the market. So there may have been some business decisions there that were a little concerning, but it was so long ago. Frankly, I don't remember very much. I'm sure that there have been studies written up about it, and you know, people can go look at those. I think you're hitting on a very important point, though, that it's not just regulatory approval that's important. It's the rest of the space into which that product falls, regardless of whether it's a plant or an animal-based food product. That's really critically important, and that's part of what I'm looking at in my work at MIT, which is the larger governance space, which includes everything from funding to stakeholder groups to what are the other competing products on the market? What are the laws that are regulating things? How much international harmonization is there? Can you trade these products? Can you trade them freely? What are the competing interests within a specific company? Who are your competitors? What are they going to be looking at? All of that goes into the governance, and particularly important is how the public feels about these things. There are concerns about safety, yes, but there are also values-based concerns that are very strong in this space. People are concerned about whether we should be doing this at all, or whether or not you're encouraging multinational corporations to have monopolies on particular types of seeds or animals. But those tend to be, they tend to often conflate with the safety concerns. And that's in large part because I think people feel there's nowhere to take their values-based concerns.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point to make. And we're definitely going to touch on that later because it's always a huge topic when we talk about emerging technologies. So I want to go back now to talk a little bit about cell-based meat. So you said it was interesting to you. I think it's fascinating. I think our whole crew here thinks it's a fascinating technology. And you've been relatively active in the cell-based meat community. So I just, So kind of just right off the bat, what makes you so passionate about that field and what are your hopes for its future?
Well, it's an emerging biotechnology, right? So that's been my field from the beginning. And I think one of the things that's interesting about it from a regulatory and governance perspective is the extent to which the lessons we've learned from other forms of biotechnology can apply, or the extent to which the, let's refer to it as the GMO penalty box, is going to apply. There are some really fascinating things about the technology itself, how one starts with a biopsy or a sample of tissue from an animal or a carcass, takes those cells, de-differentiates them into a more pluripotent stem cells, and then differentiates those cells into muscle, adipose, connective tissue, and a number of other things. Just the magic of that biology is fascinating to begin with. And although it's not magic, it just looks like magic. It's actually really hard science that goes into it. For me, I'm just so fascinated by these things. It all sort of seems like, this is... You know, people go into science because they're interested in solving riddles and answering questions. And one of the reasons why you're interested in answering questions and solving riddles is because you want to understand how things work and understand the beauty of nature that's behind that. So for me, there's not just an intellectual component, there's also an aesthetic component to the actual molecular biology, but I kind of digress about it. The thing about cellular agriculture is at the moment, there's a lot of dispute about what to call the final product that comes out of the cellular agriculture of food arising from animals. And for a while, people called it clean meat, and then people were calling it lab-based meat, and then people were calling it cell-based meat. And as you know, there are laws that are being passed in various states, and there are groups who are very concerned that the products of these technologies should not be referred to as meat because they believe that meat comes from the hoof or poultry, which doesn't have hoofs. Even though I'm a molecular biology, I know that chickens don't have hoofs. So, I think there, let's just for the sake of this discussion, call it cell-based meat. And I think the thing that's really interesting about this is that, you know, people are very concerned about climate change and about the impact that humans have had on the planet. And those two are sometimes linked and sometimes unlinked. But basically, agriculture has really changed the way that the planet looks. Now, obviously, people have to eat. We have to have agriculture, but agriculture does leave a footprint on the planet. So one of the things that people have been concerned about is how much of a footprint livestock and other meat-producing animals leave on the planet. So one of the reasons that people are touting cell-based meat is that you could decrease the environmental footprint of farming. Ranching, raising poultry, pork production, whatever. So that's one of the things that people are concerned about. Another thing that people like about cell-based meat is the animal welfare issue. I think people are uncomfortable with the idea, people who don't grow up on farms, and remember, four generations ago, 90% of our people lived on or very near a farm. And right now, it's something like 10% of the people in this country have a farmer within one generation. So most people don't know where their food comes from or how it comes from. And they're used to thinking of animals as pets. And so the idea of slaughtering an animal for a food is not a pleasant idea for a lot of people because of the association with pets as opposed to having been brought up on a farm and raising animals for food. So I think the animal welfare issue is a big one here. And I think another one is you know, here are some opportunities, especially in the fish field, to really make a difference to potential to delaying or belaying entirely extinction of certain species. In livestock agriculture, in terrestrial mammalian agriculture, you can breed up a population of animals to supply food, provided that you have the right growing conditions. But if you're catching wild fish, you can't breed up a stock because it's wild. And if you overfish a stock so that there aren't enough reproducing animals left, we could collapse entire populations and species of fish. What lab-based production of fish tissue will do is to relieve some of the pressure on those wild populations so that we don't have to worry about what's going to happen when we eat the last fish, the last wild fish. So, I mean, those are some of the reasons that I'm interested in the field. Another reason I'm really interested in the field is for the future potential. I mean, for thinking about climate change and loss of land that's suitable for raising animals or temperature conditions that are unsuitable for raising animals, then it might be good to have an alternative way of producing meats. Especially in areas of the world where it's difficult to produce livestock for food because of endemic disease or poor climatic conditions. And you can actually decrease the carbon footprint if you can scale up and make economically viable one of these production facilities and make meat where it's been impossible to make meat. So one place where it's impossible to bring to raise a herd of animals or a flock of poultry is in space. If we're going to be living up, no, think about it seriously. I mean, if we're really thinking about flying to Mars, if we're really thinking about colonizing the moon or living on the space station or some equivalent of the space station, what are you going to do for food? You know, you can't fly a spaceship, a supply ship out to a Martian mission every couple of months to replenish it. And I'm sure you all remember the line from the movie The Martian, where Matt Damon tries to figure out what he's going to eat. And he says, we're going to have to science the hell out of this. So how do you science the hell out of making food on a Mars mission? Well, maybe you do it with lab-grown meat. I mean, and I know that's far in the future, but as I said, we're doing some real horizon scanning here. So maybe that's a really good opportunity for us to focus on.
Yeah.
Hi, Larissa. It's Kelly again. I have a question just on this topic of cell-based meats. Lauren and I both were at several meetings and have seen quite a progression in the naming conventions that people have been using over even the course of this year. And going from clean meat, like you had mentioned, now to different variations of cell-based meat or things. The question I have is, when it comes to the regulatory forum of the naming convention, how do you think, or what are your thoughts on how this will actually be resolved in terms of the naming convention? If it will be solely with the USDA at the time of final approval, if that's where they land as far as the jurisdiction goes, or will it be determined in a joint partnership between FDA and USDA? Just wondering if you have any thoughts on how this naming convention will ever be resolved in the future when we think about products that could potentially, and like you say, many, many years from now, or maybe sooner than later, it's hard to say, coming to market
sooner than later. Yeah. So, I'm in some ways I'm sad I'm not at the agency to be working on this right now. And in other ways, I'm glad I'm not at the agency trying to work these things through. And my hat is off to the people who are trying to work these things through. I trust the agencies when they say they're going to be working together to resolve this. I think both Secretary Perdue and Commissioner Gottlieb have really done a heroic job of trying to get the agencies to work together. And I think what we're waiting for now is kind of the nuts. And I think there's been an expression of a strategy. We're going to work together to do this, and likely the FDA will do the oversight of the culturing, and the USDA will do oversight from culture, from harvesting through market. But we don't know what that means. And so I think we're all, there was a comment period that was open. A number of companies who are involved in this submitted comments to the agencies with recommendations. And I think one of the things that the agencies really need to be commended on at this point is asking for public input prior to these markets, to these products appearing on the market, as opposed to at the same time that they're likely to be on the market. So there have been a number of public meetings held already by either the FDA, the USDA, or jointly. And I can't imagine that there wouldn't be more public meetings. So I think my answer to this is sort of stay tuned. I don't know how the naming convention is going to turn out. I know there are parties who are very upset about these products being called meat. There are parties who are very concerned about plant-based beverages being called almond milk. I actually looked up the Canadian regulations for what we call plant-based milks here. And in Canada, you don't call them milks. You call them beverages or drinks. I don't know if the U.S. is going to follow that convention or not. I think these are questions that involve both legal opinions, regulatory status, public opinion in many ways, and the entire political environment in which we find ourselves. So I'm just going to sit and watch at this point on the naming conventions. I have some strong opinions about safety determinations, but on the naming conventions, I'm going to remain agnostic.
Well, and even expanding on that, I think I've seen, I don't know if it was a scientific paper or sort of a news article talking about the different types of names that are being considered for what we're calling lab-based meat in this conversation and consumer reaction to that. And I think I really am curious about consumer acceptance overall that we're seeing so far with lab-based meat. I think you brought up a lot of really good, like, quote-unquote selling points for it, the potential for lower environmental footprint, the potential for obviously like better animal welfare because, you know, you could alleviate some concerns there. But I would maybe liken this to GMOs a little bit in that, you know, or what is colloquially called GMOs, you know, where there's a lot of really good potential benefit. The science is very sound, but then consumer acceptance has really sort of limited the spread of that technology. How is consumer acceptance looking for lab-based meat?
You know, that's kind of the $10 million question, right? So there are a lot of people who are investing tons and tons of money into various forms of protein substitute, whether they're plant-based or lab-based meats. You know, the big food companies, Tyson's, Cargill, have put money into it. The Gates Foundation has put in a fair amount of money, or maybe it's Mr. Gates himself. There is an awful lot of money going into this. I think the capitalization for the plant-based market is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not in the low billions, and the capitalization for the lab-based meats, it lags behind that because there isn't a product just yet, but that's in still the capitalization is in the many tens of millions and probably approaching hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think industry is betting on this being a big thing. So public acceptance here is a really interesting question, and it's something that I'm looking at, particularly with some of my colleagues who are ethicists. And I talked about some of the potential benefits, but you need to understand that I was talking about those as potential benefits and not actual benefits, because in point of fact, we haven't actually scaled up to make enough lab-based meats to know what the market penetration is going to be like. We haven't scaled up enough to do a full life cycle analysis. So it's fine to say we're going to have a lower environmental footprint, but until you have data and information that allows you to compare that to an advanced rearing facility, we don't know what the inputs and the outputs are going to be and what the carbon footprint is going to be like. Recently, there was a paper that came out of Oxford University that said, well, maybe it's not going to be quite as beneficial as we think it's going to be. But I think, again, that's all based on modeling. And until we have some actual data, it's going to be hard to tell about the environmental footprint. So one of the things I think that Lauren and I have been at conferences together, and I think she's heard me say that the worst thing that could be done right now would be to overhype the technology. And to make that was the big problem with what we're calling GMOs right now. And sometimes the overhyping was a function of the language that's used for venture capital who want a good return, and you sort of really have to sell your business to get an investment. So you tend to overstate the positives. And some of this was sort of, I would say, either innocent misunderstandings of what people said that the technology could offer, or willful misstatements of what people said the technology could say. So, you know, if you're promising to, I don't know, have an herbicide tolerant something, then it's possible for people to say, well, you know, you told us this was going to have X times more yield and it doesn't. I'm just pulling that out of my hat. I don't know that people have actually said that or not. But I think it's really important to put caveats around this thing and say, we hope that. But it's early in the technology. I mean, we're hoping that gene therapy is going to solve a lot of diseases. But, you know, we're still in the early clinical trial stage. We're still in the early trial stage here as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really, really important to make sure that the public understands where and how this meat is made. Now, there may be some religious concerns about this. I think people need to consult religious scholars to find out if, and there's been some preliminary work done on this to find out if the meat is going to be halal or if it's going to be kosher. I think those are important questions to ask. I think taste is going to have a lot to do with it. Is this stuff really going to taste like meat? You know, the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger are plant-based, but they're doing pretty well in the market so far. And people seem to be eating them. Here in Kendall Square, you can get the Impossible Burger from many lunch places or even in a scramble for breakfast. So, you know, it depends a lot on how people are going to feel about it. I don't think this is an or situation. I don't think we're ever going to go from, quote unquote, meat on the hoof to all lab-based meat. I think it's going to be an and situation. I think we're going to have both. And I think the penetration will likely be incremental. You know, I think there probably are sufficient positives here for companies who are making mixed products to start incorporating X percent of lab-based meat in with more conventionally derived meat for their products. But, you know, they're competing. There are competing economic interests within the industry, within a company, and within the larger environment. People who going back to the ethics question, I mean, we don't want to say that our ranchers and our animal breeders and all the people who have been providing food for us for thousands of years are bad or unethical because we think that lab-based meat is more ethical. You know, what are we going to do if we're going to go to a lot of lab-based meat? What are we going to do with all the people whose jobs will be displaced? I mean, this is not unlike any other disruptive technology. The disruption goes all the way down to the individual person level. What are we going to do about my job? You know, not everybody who breeds cattle or not everybody who raises cattle is going to be a lab technician. So I think that's an important ethical issue to take into account when one does the full life cycle analysis of these products. And one of the things that I'm working on is trying to identify all of these questions and find ways that we can talk about them in environments that allow for rational discussion, as opposed to people getting mad and yelling at each other.
Yeah. Larissa, you've made a lot of great points to consider as we think about the technology. And I had an additional question about the consumer and the consumer awareness. There's been a lot of communication about cell-based foods, and I'm actually surprised by the number of friends who are outside of the industry who ask me about the technology and what's happening and just the reach that the communication has had so far. And so I'm curious, from your experience with other technologies, like, is this the earliest that you've seen such communication with the public and the consumer as a technology is in the earlier development stages? Or are there examples of other technology that, you know, have had this communication early on? And is there something that we can learn from past experiences?
In the bio world, this is the earliest. In the non-therapeutic bio world, so in other words, the food space or the environment space, this is the most communication I've seen in the past. I think people learned a lot from the lessons of GMOs, for example. I mean, the hyping, the not involving the consumer. I can't tell how much the public who's not actually involved in this is finding out about it or reading about it, because I have all these push services, so I have an ascertainment bias. It's kind of all I see. You have to take what I say with a grain of salt. But, you know, I was interviewed on Marketplace to find out a little bit about clean meats. I know that the major newspapers have been writing about it. I know that the business journals have been writing about it. And I don't know, and certainly if you go to higher end grocery stores, there are, you know, Beyond Burgers available in the chilled meat case. I don't know what the right term for that is. You probably do. But you can buy the Beyond Burger, but none of the meat products are yet available because they haven't been scaled up enough to be economically viable. But I think that's probably just a matter of time. It's a technological problem that people are working very hard to solve. And there are some very, very smart people working in this field. One of them used to work for me. But there are a lot of really, really good people working in this field. So I think this is an experiment in real time, you know? And so, you know, if I were to say to a company that's thinking about this, that's not a startup that's making these foods, I would start preparing my board. I would start preparing my management. I would get the communications people involved. You know, there are lots of things that can and should be done, but the important thing is to have a substantive engagement with the public and not just lecturing at them. We know that the knowledge deficit model of communication, where basically we say the same thing over and over, louder and louder, and think that if people knew what we knew, they think the way that we think, just doesn't work. You have to have a base of factual knowledge that can be trusted. And that probably shouldn't come from industry, because people will have a natural distrust of people who have a vested economic interest in the acceptance of the technology. So there needs to be some other mechanism by which factual information about production, safety, environmental issues can be found. I don't know what that is, but I think that's something we as a society need to work on. But I think industry, especially B2B and most of all B2C, needs to think very seriously about preparing themselves and their customers for this.
And so we've kind of crossed a lot of the different sort of hurdles that are facing cell-based meat sort of in this present time. So there's the issue of scale-up you mentioned. Obviously, communication is an issue now probably and definitely going to be an issue as this maybe becomes more of a commercial process. And really just the stage of the technology, the current stage of it. But would you maybe identify, is there like one hurdle that is really significant for the cell-based meat community that's really inhibiting bringing a marketable product or ingredient beyond sort of these niche markets that it's in right now?
Well, that's a really good question. And if I knew the answer to that, I probably would be a very wealthy consultant.
That's why I'm asking. I just want the idea.
Yeah. It's I think it's not one thing. I think it's a mixture of things. And to look for a magic bullet is probably not what we need to do. I think again, it needs to be scaled up. It needs to be economically. This should not be food for rich people, right? This should be food for everybody. There needs to be really clear communication about what is a benefit and where there is not a benefit. I think the important thing here is real honesty through a reliable source. And whether those are academics or foundations, I don't know. But it can't be anybody who has a vested financial interest in the sale of the product. I think that having substantial engagement with the public and finding out what they're concerned about is really important. I think contacting religious scholars and finding out if there are any religious objections and then making those known is really important. And then I think it's important to find out sort of where the NGOs are on this. You know, what are their concerns? You know, one always wants to mold the environment in which one wants to find oneself. And the best way to do that is to try to map that environment so that you know where you've been, where you are, and where you're going to go. And so that's what I'm doing as part of my research at MIT and trying to help other folks along with it as they think about how to move forward.
That's great. And I really want to dig in a little bit more on the communication aspect here, because it's really come up as we throughout our whole conversation, because really beyond regulations, communication really is one of the big hurdles for acceptance of new technology. You know, we can come out with these technologies, integrate them into foods, but if it's not accepted well by consumers, then it's not going to happen. So, you know, I think you summed it up really well in terms of the levels of considerations that consumers will have. There's safety-based considerations all the way through value-based considerations. And I think navigating the communication of these technologies really is quite challenging. So I'm really curious on your insights on how you've navigated this previously. Do you have some success stories you can enlighten us with?
Oh, well, you know, I've spent the last 15 years at the FDA, and it was very clearly not the agency's job to either support or oppose a technology. The agency was limited to talking about whether or not, how the agency would determine whether something was safe, and in the case of a new animal drug, safe and effective. And not to have an opinion beyond that. But I think what I learned from watching other people do this, and what I've learned from the last couple of years in the academic and the little tiny bit of consulting that I do, is that communication has to be straightforward and it has to be multi-directional. You can't just talk at people. You have to ask people, and people have to feel like their concerns are being taken into account. So if somebody says, how do I know this is safe? You need to be able to explain to somebody in terms that they can understand how and why it's safe. And if that means, you know, taking tour groups through your company and showing what's being done and how well you do it, then that's part of what needs to be done. talking to school groups, talking to teachers is really important because teachers have a whole big role in educating the, you know, the people who are coming up beyond behind us. I think talking to the public, writing articles in journals that people read, social media is going to play such a huge role here. And I am not of the generation that grew up in social media, but I can tell you that, you know, this is all over Twitter. This is, you know, this is all over LinkedIn. This is all mm-hmm. over Instagram. I'm one of the few people on the planet who does not have a Facebook account. so I don't know.
It's there too, I can tell you.
so I don't know if it's on Facebook or not. But I social media is going to be big, and it's really important to get facts out there. You know, I think one only needs to look at the history of anti-vaxxers and the measles outbreaks that we're having right now to find out the role of disinformation. And whether that's well-meaning or intentional is really immaterial. The point is that people's concerns were not being met in a way that resonated with them. And so they adopted positions that were ultimately deleterious to the public health and to their very own health.
So your work at the FDA was focused on looking at whether or not these different things were safe, but there wasn't necessarily a formal approval that comes out of it?
Well, no, that depends. So for the plant products, those were regulated by the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, and were basically, there were some policy papers that came out and some guidances that came out. And so that's a voluntary consultation. And what the agency issues at the end of that is a letter saying, here's the data that we evaluate, data and information that we evaluated, and we have no further questions. Mm-hmm. In the bioengineered animal component, there is a formal approval. So you may not mark it until you have an approval from FDA.
Okay.
And the agency does come out and say, this is safe, and it does what it's supposed to do.
And so do you think in the cases where there is not sort of that formal approval, do consumers that are, you know, further removed from the industry and how to navigate the regulations associated with it, is there some frustration there?
I think there may be, but you know, this is such a very complicated regulation of products and processes is a really complicated area. I think often people don't understand the fundamental law, which is food must be safe. If food is not safe, it gets pulled off the market. And I think, you know, FSMA and the other laws that we have in place right now really help bring that home. Food must be safe. And so whether that's from a voluntary consultation or from an approval of an article that's regulated under the new animal drug provisions of the Act, the public has to have confidence that their food is safe. And I think unlike Europe, in the United States, the public still has a great regard for agency opinions. And so I think if the agency says, we have no further questions about the safety of this, that the public is probably pretty comfortable with that. To go to a mandatory approval system for plants is the subject of several other podcasts that we probably don't have to go through right now. Yeah, and get a couple of lawyers. Because they really
know this
stuff.
Well, yeah. And to wrap us up, kind of bringing it back to sort of the larger topic of this episode and new technology integration into food, what advice would you have for our listeners who might be looking to develop food products that include these new and emerging technologies?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say would be take a deep breath. And understand that this is not going to be something that's going to be rolled out as, great, we have this great new sausage that fries up better or something like that. That there's going to be a lot of work that needs to go into this, both from the technical side, getting your company ready for it, and then making sure that the public is ready for it. And to the extent that companies and trade groups and professional associations can help develop some of the data and information that goes into this with a hands-off approach to any funding that they do. I would encourage them to seriously think about that. There are some very fine research and 501c3 groups right now who are funding basic research into lab-based meats. And I think if a company wanted to go into this, if they wanted to make an investment that would help generate some of those data, I think that would be useful. You know, early in the development of a technology, the developers are not so much competitors as they are collaborators, because without that baseline of information, no one can move forward. So I think it requires a slightly different mindset that, you know, we all need to have this base from which we can operate. We've always had it with traditionally based meats because the assumption has always been a healthy animal is likely to be safe to eat. So everybody worked off that baseline. Here we're working on a different baseline. And the more people contribute to developing that baseline across the technology, as opposed to for their own particular needs, I think the better off everyone will be.
That's great. And I think that's a great place to leave it. So Larissa, thanks so much for your time and your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
It's been my very great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you so much, Larissa. We've really enjoyed this conversation with you.
If you're interested in learning more about muscle foods or continuing the conversation, you can head on over to IFT's online community, IFT Connect, and join the Muscle Foods division. If you're enjoying Food Disruptors, please let us know by leaving a review on iTunes or by connecting with IFT. You can find us at IFT on Twitter and by searching the Institute of Food Technologists or IFT Muscle Foods Division on Facebook and LinkedIn. Thanks for listening to Food Disruptors. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden. Have a great day, everyone.